Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll go back to the 1960s. Many young middle-class Americans weren't happy with the suburban lifestyle, so they came to Appalachia to live in rural places with folks who didn't have a lot of money. Virginia Bonds remembers those vistas and Appalachian volunteers who showed up in her neck of the woods during the summer of 1966.
And when I saw the vistas coming, I thought, Lord have mercy, what are they coming here for?
Yeah.
Took a little bit of talking to get me to get into it, and once I did, it was all right.
And we'll hear an excerpt from Jay, A Rockefeller's Journey, a documentary that just won a regional Emmy Award. In it, former Senator Jay Rockefeller talks about his time in West Virginia as a VISTA volunteer.
And I kept a diary every day, which I didn't read for 50 years. It was sort of like a sacred document to me. In reading that, I realized how much I grew, how I changed, how much they did, the people of Emmons, to make me who I believe I am.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Hey, Inside Appalachia fans, we have some pretty exciting news to share. We've just launched our very first TV episode of Inside Appalachia. The one-hour program hears from people who were affected by this year's historic floods. We'll hear how they're looking to rebuild their homes and their communities. That's at wvpublic.org. And let us know what you think.
Down in the valley, about a mile from me, where the crows no longer cry, there's a great big earth-moving monster machine, stands 10 stories high. The ground he can't eat is a sight, takes 100 tons at a bite. He can dig up the grass, it's a fact, but he can't put it back.
Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We've talked a few times on this show about the war on poverty. It focused federal aid money to poor black communities in the South and poor rural communities in West Virginia and Kentucky. On today's episode, we're going to hear from some folks who worked on the front lines on some of those projects, VISTAs, or Volunteers in Service to America. In December of 1964, President Johnson welcomed the first group of 20 VISTA volunteers.
Your pay will be low. The conditions of your labor will often be difficult. But you will have the satisfaction of leading a great national effort. And you will have the ultimate reward, which comes to those who serve their nation and who serve their fellow man.
VISTA volunteers had to take an oath of poverty. Back then, VISTAs were truly volunteers, living with families in the communities where they were stationed, without a wage or stipend from the government. Most of these VISTAs were young, middle, or upper-class university graduates. Many of those early VISTAs came to Appalachia. In 1966, Virginia Bonds and her husband Ernest were living in Pine Knob, West Virginia.
And when I saw the VISTAs coming, I thought, Lord have mercy, what are they coming here for?
Yeah.
Took a little bit of talking to get me to get into it, and once I did, it was all right.
VISTA volunteers tend to be idealists and dreamers.
This is Roxy Todd, our producer. I've asked Roxy to join me on the show today to help us understand a little bit more about these young VISTA volunteers who came to work in Appalachia during the 1960s, but also to help us understand a little more about the program that VISTA has become today.
Many of them, like me, signed up because, quite frankly, they didn't know what to do with their lives.
Roxy's not a native of West Virginia. She was a VISTA volunteer herself in 2010 and 2011 in Pocahontas and Randolph County. Yes, there are still VISTAs around today. So some folks might say you're an outsider there, Roxy.
I'm an outsider, born and raised in Middle Tennessee. I went to college in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Asheville, North Carolina, and that's where I really learned that there was this place called Appalachia. When I was a VISTA in West Virginia, my supervisor was a man named Gibbs Kinderman.
I helped supervise one of the first 14 rural VISTAs in 1965.
And was Gibbs from this area?
He grew up in California.
So how did he find his way to southern West Virginia during the 1960s?
Gibbs was a recent graduate of Harvard, and I think he was about to go to grad school, and that's what his family expected him to do. And then in 1963, he saw Martin Luther King give his famous I Have a Dream speech. So he skipped out on his plans for grad school and instead got in a car with some friends and headed down to Mississippi to help register black voters. Then Gibbs was recruited by Milton Ogle to come to Appalachia and work for the Council of the Southern Mountains. He was one of the ones who helped create a new program called the Appalachian Volunteers. So he moved to eastern Kentucky and then to West Virginia.
In 1965, Appalachian Volunteers had a summer project with about 150 college kids. And in 1966, there were 500 college kids. And the project was sponsored by VISTA and by the Peace Corps. Sergeant Shriver was the head of both. And the idea was to get young people who might be potential Peace Corps volunteers and give them like a summer tryout in the, quote, domestic Peace Corps to see how they did.
Isn't it just a little bit strange that the government thought that sending folks to Appalachia was a way to test people for the Peace Corps? I mean, that's just about like saying we're a third world country, don't you think?
Well, right. I suppose in some ways that is one way to look at it. Appalachia was and still is a very different and exotic place. But part of what drove those VISTAs here was because it was so different and something very unique. They wanted that experience.
But still, it kind of seems like the government was saying, oh, these poor, helpless Appalachians, they can't think for themselves, and we better go in and help them out. And
well, it was a cultural exchange. They were trying to bring in college graduates and law students, maybe not so much just for their intelligence and their education, but also to kind of inject some idealism into Appalachia. Here's Naomi Cohen, who was recruited as a VISTA back in 1966.
I said I was going to do something interesting, and I signed up to go to Mississippi for one of the voter registration drives. And one of the law students who was organizing that came to me and said, we've got too many volunteers for Mississippi. You know, we just have more people who want to go than there are places to go to. Would you be interested in going to Appalachia? And I said, where's that? And he said, you know, West Virginia, Kentucky, you know, all those states with the mountains in them where poor people live. Would you be interested in doing that instead? There's a group called the Appalachian Volunteers, which is looking for summer volunteers, including law students. And I thought about it for 30 seconds and said, okay.
In the summer of 66, Naomi Cohen was a law student. Her VISTA supervisor was Gibbs Kinderman, who assigned Naomi to work in the Pine Knob community in Raleigh County, West Virginia. And here's why Gibbs decided to send VISTAs like Naomi to Pine Knob.
Well, when I first came to West Virginia, which was in January of 1966, I worked for an organization called the Council of the Southern Mountains. And Ned Chilton, who was the editor of the Charleston Gazette, was a board member. So my boss said, go introduce yourself to Mr. Chilton. And he introduced me to Don Marsh, who was the kind of attack dog reporter for the Gazette, later became the editor. And Don Marsh said, if you want to do any good, go to Pine Knob. Those people are really being done bad by the strip miners.
So I thought this was really fascinating, and I wanted to hear from somebody that was a native to the area, that lived there, and find out how they felt when they first heard about the VISTAs coming to West Virginia. And I went to Pine Knob for the first time in Raleigh County, which frankly was beautiful. You just go through this holler, and you've got mountains surrounding you on both ways, and you just keep coming across house after house. Anyway, finally I got to Virginia Bonds, and she was there during the 1960s, and her memory was still clear of what happened during that time. And she shared these stories about boulders rolling into her mother's house, or close to her mother's house, rather, and water from old mines that began pouring down the side of the mountain.
It was just tore everything up. one day I was on the porch and I said, I hear water running. And my husband said, it can't be. It's sunshiny and it's pretty. But they had drilled into a deep mine up here and the water just came down. I could hear it come down the mountain and I could see the trees moving a day about like this. And down below where my mother lived, a rock came down. It's bigger than your chair, the chair you're sitting in. A huge rock came down into the creek. And one day another one came down and it bounced across the road and into our garden.
And then also another native was Daryl McGraw. So let's play another clip to hear from what he thought about it. And he was an aide to Governor Smith back when the Vistas were working along Coal River.
Surface mining was really eroding West Virginia in a literal sense. The strippers called the process shoot and shove, all right, and those less dedicated to militaristic or military terms called it rape and run.
So along came these Vistas.
Traveling down that coal town road.
David Bismarck, he was here often. I would make him a sandwich and feed him on the porch. Finally, one day I said, David, you've been here so many times. I want you to come table and eat with us. So he did.
Roxy, you know David Biesmeyer, this former Vista. Can you tell us about him?
So in 66, David Biesmeyer was a 26-year-old law student who came to Pine Knob. Virginia Bonds was one of the first West Virginians that he met.
She was. I guess I met her because the first week or two that I was in West Virginia, I was in Pine Knob, which is a community up a hollow from Neoma on the Coal River. And each spring, that community has a big ramp supper. And that was a big event. But just before the ramp supper, a large boulder had been blasted off the side of a strip mine above the building, the community building, the ramp supper was held in, and the boulder rolled down and about penetrated about halfway through the back of the building. And so it sort of upset plans, and Jenny was one of the big organizers of the ramp supper.
Jenny
Bonds, Virginia Bonds, right. I call her Jenny. And that's how I first met her, but what I was recalling was that in that summer, which was 1966, she fixed sandwiches and lunch and things for me on her kitchen table. And I was back to see her just a couple months ago. And this is now, 2015, and I had sandwiches on the same table that we had them on in 1966. And she's just a very strong and very sweet woman.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear more about what happened when Vistas like David Biesmeyer began to help Virginia Bonds and the people of Pine Knob. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
I've stood for the Union, walked in the line, fought against the company. Stood for the UMWRV, now who's going to stand for me? I got no house and I got no pay, just got a worried soul and this blue tattoo on the side of my head left by
All right, so when we left off, former Vista volunteer David Biesmeyer was recalling when he was a 26-year-old law student turned Vista volunteer. He found himself in West Virginia for the first time in 1966. By the way, here's what David's first impression was of Appalachia.
I had no idea what to expect. I grew up on the Great Plains, right at the corner of Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. So when I got here, it looked to me like every place was a state park. You know, every time you went around a corner, there was something new and beautiful and very different from what I grew up around. So I loved it immediately.
Now, I should mention that David Biesmeyer says none of his supervisors told him directly to start focusing on strip mining. Even if that might have been part of the plan that his supervisor, Gibbs Kinderman, had in the back of his mind. At first, these vistas were assigned to meet people in the community and to help find daytime activities for the neighborhood children.
We actually started out starting camps for kids. I remember we had two camps, one up Beach Hollow. One was called Camp Cornflake, and the other was called Camp Hubcap, because it was in an old garage that was full of hubcaps.
And again, here's Naomi Cohen.
By day, you might say we were day camp counselors and tutors of children. But by evening, we were out there organizing and getting people stirred up about issues. I mean, I sometimes felt that we were doing two different things. By the end of the summer, or by the middle of the summer, I was just doing a lot more traveling around, talking to people, and, you know, also going to other places and, you know, trying to get people organized on the strip mine issue. We were trying to convince people that by community organizing they could change the West Virginia state law and make the law more responsive to people and more protective of the property rights of people instead of just the strip mine operators.
So if this wasn't the goal of the organizers, how did they start working to fight strip mining?
Well, David says that it was pretty clear once he started talking with Virginia Bonds and some of her neighbors that strip mining was basically the thing that they were dealing with and most concerned with. Meanwhile, folks in neighboring communities were having a lot of the same issues with strip mining. With the vistas all spread out and different haulers up and down, they started connecting these different people and encouraging them to come to meetings together and really share their concerns. You know, there was no internet or Facebook, and community organizing was really all just word of mouth back then.
Kind of like the goals of all these people, or they had situations that they were in, and they really didn't know what to do about it or if they could do anything about it, frankly.
Rock came off the mountain and went through a windshield of a station wagon and killed one of my students. And it was a devastating situation. It just took off part of his head, and it was, you know, a horrible experience for everyone in the community.
That's horrible. That just seems so traumatizing for the family and the people in the community. How did the community respond?
Well, they were angry. That was a teacher, Ina Mae Painter, who was over in a neighboring community in Boone County, and the child of that horrible accident was killed, of course, and his family wasn't compensated. And the vistas, like David Biesmeyer, began to convince these folks and some of the folks in Pine Knob that if they wanted protection against the strip mines, they really had to help pass a new law.
A group of folks from the community, at our, you know, suggestion at least, decided they would go to Charleston and talk to members of the legislature. And so there was a several carloads of people who made the first trip down. This was within, I don't know, several weeks, I guess, of my being in Pine Knob. That's how concerned people were. And so they started talking to the legislature. I think that was actually an interesting development because I don't think people felt as connected or as informed about government as they do today. People then would talk about how those decisions are made in Charleston as if there was no direct connection between them and the government going, you know, conducting its affairs in Charleston. So the idea of going to Charleston and talking to members of the legislature was kind of, that was a new and a scary idea for people. But they stepped up and did it.
I can see the people stirring through the valleys and the hills. I can hear the people stirring as I go, as I go. I can feel the people stirring.
Ellis Bailey was one of the folks who went with the Vistas to testify before the State House in 1967. Tell us more about who he was, Roxy.
Ellis Bailey was a disabled underground coal miner himself. He lived along the Clear Fork of the Coal River, and his farm was really being damaged by the strip mining that was being done above his home. Here he is talking about the damage that was done to his farm, and he's actually acting as himself in a 1969 film that was made about the strip mining in Pine Knob.
I don't get to enjoy life like I used to enjoy life. And the very thing that brought us all of us in the area is the stripper. He has damaged our water, our land, our forest. To a poor man has not got the right that he has had. Every man should have his own right. But the poor man's right to being destroyed right today. And the strip mine has done more to destroy the poor class of people than anything that's ever hit our area.
And that film, you said Bailey was acting himself as himself?
Right. That was Ellis Bailey. He was reenacting a speech he made to the West Virginia State Legislature in a 1969 docudrama. And that film was called Before the Mountain Was Moved, and it was nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah, Virginia Bonds pointed that out and said that she was in it, and she remembers people coming to her house, actually, when they were filming. And we've posted that entire film for you to watch for free on our website, wvpublic.org. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We're talking about one of the first projects organized by Young Vistas in Appalachia during the 1960s, with help from our producer, Roxy Todd, a former Vista herself. Law students David Biesmeyer and Naomi Cohen worked to encourage folks in southern West Virginia to ask state lawmakers for safer strip mining regulations. And now this is something Virginia Bonds talked about when I went to visit her. And she talked about going to the Capitol and lobbying for safer regulations and for a specific law. Were they successful? Tell us about that.
They were. In 66 and 67, both Naomi and David took a year off law school so they could continue to work as Appalachian volunteers. And they helped organize folks like Virginia Bonds and Ellis Bailey into this group of lobbyers that would just show up at the Capitol. And for a lot of them, this was the first time they'd ever been to the state Capitol, much less get up and speak in front of a packed room of state legislators. And what they were asking for was a law that would help protect them as landowners and as residents against the strip mining that was being done around their house. State Senator Paul Kaufman was one of the biggest supporters of the bill. Here he is in the film, Before the Mountain Was Moved, explaining the bill to the people of Pine Knob.
How are you? Good to appear before your committee today.
Well, good. We need
you. This is Senator Paul Kaufman. His committee is the committee that's going to be reviewing the bill, and he'll be fighting to get a strong strip mine bill on the floor of the Senate.
Nice to see you. Good to see you. We need you here.
Thank you.
We can use your support. I think we've got a pretty good bill going in, which you've read, I know, but it needs to be improved. And some of the points in it, some of the sections which are they're trying to get out, that they're trying to strike out, well, maybe you can help us keep it in. That's Section 10. You know, you're familiar with Section 10, which would give the Director of Natural Resources the power to stop strip mining when it was doing a lot of damage, as it does in places where you come from.
Thank
you. Yes, sir.
And in March of 1967, that bill passed the Senate and then the House.
This is Capital News Central, WCHS Television News, the largest television news gathering force in the tri-state area. And now, Bill Richards.
Good evening. This is Frank Annan substituting for Bill Richards. The House of Delegates defeated attempts today to soften a bill which would establish hard regulations against strip mining in West Virginia.
Daggone, boys. What do you know about that?
Delegates refused to accept changes in the proposed law.
Can't hear.
They went against the recommendation of their own committee of lawyers and the example of their leaders.
He's hearing the voice of the people.
Their opponents in disarray, they passed a strip mining bill in a form sought by conservationists by a vote of 98 to 1.
I'm satisfied.
So I wanted to know how Virginia Bonds felt when this happened and the law passed, and here's what she had to say.
Well, I don't know how much protection was, really, I don't know, but I felt like we had done something good. It wasn't too easy, but we did something good. They don't strip here now, but my grandson's making a living as a strip mine. There's nothing to get. There's nothing to do.
And then I asked her if she thinks that things have gotten better with the strip mining and the mountaintop removal mining.
I don't know. I don't like strip mining, for that matter, where they take the top of the mountain off. I don't like that. But people have to work. They have to have something to feed their families and everything. If that's all they can get, they have to take it.
And I asked David Biesmeyer if he thought that the community in Pine Knob had gotten better since the 1960s.
You know, I can't answer that question. If I drive up that hollow now, it looks more prosperous. The homes are larger, the homes are nicer, the yards are well tended, all those things. But I don't know if there's the sense of community there was back in the 1960s. And there was a very strong sense of community. People felt connected to each other and shared with each other and helped each other out. I don't know if that's still going on or not. So is the community better or worse? I don't know.
Virginia talked about how, you know, she can't get around very well right now, and she talked about how folks in the community still stop by to help her out and help her with things, and she's still very active with her church and the ramp dinner. She's very excited about the ramp dinner, and so she said she's ready to go. She can't cook like she did, but she's going to go help prepare the ramps and a lot of the food in that sense. But she also talked about how her son, or her grandson rather, is now a strip miner. So I guess there's a little bit of irony into the story so far and how things turned out now, because she mentioned that there's no other options. And she said if her grandson wasn't doing that, she doesn't know what he'd be doing. So I don't know. I certainly, there's a little bit of irony in that specific story's ending. In talking to some of the folks from Wyoming County, they mentioned that some of the vistas in that area moved to the area after volunteering there. And I think Virginia mentioned that David is actually living in Greenbrier County now, so some of them stayed.
Yeah, and David Biesmeyer, as you said, lives in Alderson, and right over the border in Monroe County, Naomi Cohen lives, and also Gibbs Kinderman lives. And they all three get together from time to time and still hang out. And there are former vistas all over Appalachia that decided to stay. I think that's pretty cool. David Biesmeyer said that if you take all the vistas out of West Virginia, you're going to have a very big hole.
Well, I felt that there was meaningful things to do in West Virginia, and I think that's what attracted me here. After I got involved with the issues with strip mining and later with the United Mine Workers, I just felt like this was my home, and I wanted to be at home.
That was David Biesmeyer, a former Vista and Appalachian volunteer who helped organize one of the first citizen lobby groups in West Virginia in 1966 and 1967. Special thanks to Gibbs Kinderman for helping us with those interviews. But the program called Appalachian Volunteers that helped bring a lot of these Vistas to West Virginia, that program didn't last. Politicians throughout Appalachia began to complain that these Vista volunteers were putting seditious or radical ideas in the minds and mouths of poor people. The federal agency which funded the Appalachian Volunteers, the Office of Economic Opportunity, pulled back its funding. And by 1970, the Appalachian Volunteers program closed.
However, the larger Vista program continued. Even though Vista has evolved a lot since the years when David and Naomi were organizing the people of Coal River and doing that radical work, today Vistas are strictly forbidden to participate in any type of political action or political campaign.
Really? So Vistas today are different from before. Now remember, Roxy, at the beginning of the show, you said they were dreamers and idealists.
True, they still are dreamers and idealists, but they're not allowed to do any kind of political campaigning or protesting of any kind, as Vistas. We were even warned never to post anything political on our Facebook pages or on our cars. And Vistas today are never really told about this radical early history. At least I never was. The only reason I learned was because I bugged Gibbs Kinderman enough to tell me his story.
And then I get to bug you to learn about it, too. It's a pretty incredible story. As a lifelong Southern West Virginian, I've never heard of any of that. And it's been really fascinating and eye-opening, certainly for me. So I'm really thankful for that. And it's just one story about Vistas in Central Appalachia. So how about you out there? Do you remember a Vista volunteer who came to your community? Or were you a Vista yourself and have a story to share? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us a tweet at InAppalachia. Or you can chat in person. Our producer, Roxy Todd, will be at a special gathering of Vista alums on April 22nd at West Virginia University in Morgantown. The event's open and free to the public. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. Today we've been talking about the communities in West Virginia along the Coal River, but this river wasn't always called Coal River. What was its original name and why did it change? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. The Delaware Indians first named the rivers along the Coal River Valley Walhondasepe, or Ditch Place. In the 18th century, explorer John Peter Salling renamed them Big Little and Coal River for the coal deposits found along its banks. The waters that make up the Coal River watershed have served as a vital transportation link to the Kanawha River since humans first arrived in the region. The Indians used the rivers as favorite hunting and fishing sites. According to a book by Michael B. Graham called The Coal River Valley in the Civil War, West Virginia Mountains, 1861, early settlers in the region discovered that outcrops of coal along the Big Coal River could be used as an excellent source of heat and light. The abundant timber reserves they found were also used to build a growing Kanawha Valley. If you have another story about the Coal River, or if you know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. In 1964, Jay Rockefeller came to West Virginia as a young volunteer with the Action for Appalachian Youth. The AYY was one of several pilot programs that led to the launch of Vista in December 1964. Our team here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting has been producing a new film about Rockefeller's 50-year public service career called Jay, A Rockefeller's Journey. The film will premiere in Morgantown on April 22nd at 7 in the evening at West Virginia University. Here's a special sneak peek.
I'm a child of the 60s. Sounds funny to hear myself say that, but I am. People just believed in the promise of America and the promise of what was within each of them. And they weren't afraid to take on new things, new ideas. The Peace Corps, legal aid, Head Start, and all kinds of things that were put in place by a guy named R. Sargent Shriver, who is my all-time hero.
Rockefeller graduates Harvard College in 1961 with a degree in Far Eastern languages and history. He immediately enters Yale for a five-year program to learn Chinese. But the New York Times and Life magazine articles catch the attention of the new Kennedy administration, including Sergeant Shriver, who's developing the Peace Corps program. Shriver sends a letter to Jay Rockefeller, asking him to join the effort. Rockefeller leaves Yale, joins the National Advisory Council of the Peace Corps, and becomes a special assistant to Shriver in Washington.
He was so talented. He was so determined. He just never stopped pouring out good ideas and then making good on those ideas. The Peace Corps was laughed at by many in the very early 60s. And he went to every single congressperson and lobbied and got the money.
After a year, Shriver assigns Rockefeller to head the Philippines program, the largest in the Peace Corps.
We have a project in the Philippines requiring teachers of English.
Rockefeller meets Charlie Peters, director of evaluation at the Peace Corps, a West Virginia native and former state legislator.
One day this tall, lanky guy stuck his nose into my door and said, X told me we should get to know each other, so you want to have lunch? So we had lunch, and it turned out our first not over any high intellectual calling, but we both loved baseball and football, and so we got to talking about sports.
The Harvard-educated and well-connected Rockefeller knows the Kennedy family socially. He's attended White House dinners and been to Hickory Hills, Robert Kennedy's home.
Well, I expected him to be a stuffy prig. I just didn't imagine that someone that rich would be nice. I thought he'd be spoiled to death, you know, and all of that, and very elitist. He was none of those things. He was very down-to-earth, super down-to-earth.
After 2 years in the Peace Corps, Rockefeller joins the State Department's Far Eastern Affairs Office, but soon confides in his close friend that he isn't satisfied as an administrative officer at a Washington desk. He wants a more hands-on job, working at a grassroots level, impacting poverty.
My first line of persuasion was, well, if you want to know about poverty, come to West Virginia.
Our program here in Charleston.
Robert Kennedy, who was then the Attorney General, was in charge of a program called the President's Council on Juvenile Delinquency, which was running the pilot programs that turned into the War on Poverty. And one of those was something called Action for Appalachian Youth and headquartered in Charleston. Bobby said, well, if you want to go to West Virginia, why don't you check in with those people? So Jay went to work out in a little town called Emmons.
The isolated community of Emmons, West Virginia, is located on the Kanawha County-Boone County border, 20 miles south of Charleston. Its population in 1964 is about 240. All but 13 of its 60 families are on welfare.
Anywhere I'd see him, he'd say, why, Shirley? He just seemed like one of my boys.
Lifelong Emmons resident Shirley Giles was a member of one of those working families. In 1964, her husband is a chemical worker and a Baptist preacher. Shirley is raising their two sons and attending college.
When Jay came to Emmons, first time I saw him, he came over here in the yard, and I had all my mattresses out and signed them. And I said, you must be a Rockefeller. I looked up at him. I was short, and I was right. And from then on, we were very close.
Shirley soon learns the young man has an insatiable appetite.
Pinto beans and cornbread and fried pies, and said I baked fabulous pecan pies. We'd have cucumbers and onions in a dish with vinegar on it, and he'd just stick his fingers in there and eat it.
What is amazing is that there should not be an intersection between the man and the state. Jay is part of one of the wealthiest families in the nation, and he's coming to one of the poorest states in the nation. He seems like an alien. He seems like an outsider. And the term they used was carpetbagger. How will he adapt to the Appalachia that is not at all part of his experience?
Some people rejected him because they knew he had money and because of his name. A lot of people was on welfare and things like that and drank and that's all they knew.
Being a VISTA volunteer is an incredibly intimate experience. I was this tall stranger coming from the city that everybody loved to hate and with a name that lots of people loved to hate. And so what was I doing there? It was hard to explain it to myself even at the time, but I was trying to get out of my comfort zone and to learn what real people in the real world, what they face, what they're up against.
He's kind and tender and caring and loving and patient. He had to be patient to work here in Emmons, but he wasn't afraid to put his finger in it and get it burned.
What saved me is I've always been good with kids. There's one railroad track that goes through Emmons. I would sit on the rail. They would sit on the rail. We would sort of toss rocks, not at each other, but just pick them up and toss them. And then they got comfortable. And then one of them said, oh, come on, let's go back to my house and we'll get something to eat. And that broke the whole thing. I hadn't proved myself, but I had demystified myself in some way which they found acceptable.
We've started a domestic Peace Corps called VISTA. 9,000 Americans have volunteered to serve in that for $50 a month.
The VISTA program emphasizes citizen-directed community improvement projects. But getting that input becomes another lesson in the education of Jay Rockefeller.
People generally, I think, in West Virginia are nervous about change because if you've got what you've got, at least you've got that. Even if you don't like it, you've got what you've got. And any idea of something new, doing something new, organizing a community organization was nerve-wracking. People would come to community meetings, and sometimes some of the men faced the other directions because they were not accustomed to talking in public settings. A community meeting was a strange organism and a threatening organism.
The national press follows John D. Rockefeller IV to West Virginia, which has a level of poverty only recently discovered by President Kennedy, and along with Kennedy, much of the rest of the nation. Rockefeller talks to reporters about a fatalism he sees in the community he's living in, comments that anger many West Virginians who let Jay know about it. This is the first of what will be a pattern for Jay Rockefeller throughout his career, speaking without filtering his comments, from saying West Virginians suffer with an inferiority complex while he's Secretary of State in the late 1960s, all the way to his last months in the U.S. Senate while chairing his Senate Commerce Committee, when he says some oppose the Affordable Care Act because President Obama is, quote, maybe of the wrong color. Well, I'm saying Rockefeller remains undeterred by the backlash over such comments.
You have to face up to things that potentially hold you back. And if they make people uncomfortable, then you're wrong to say it if it's not true. If it is true, somebody has to say it. Maybe it shouldn't be me, but somebody has to say it. And you have to make people want to be, as they say, all that they can be.
Eventually, the hard feelings about the comment on fatalism in Emmons dissipate to a point that allows Rockefeller to assess multiple service needs and move several basic initiatives forward.
He provided transportation to the kids to dental clinics. He tried to encourage them to go to school. He helped a lot of children in the community get jobs. I don't know whether anybody could just come in and done that. It takes a special person.
Rockefeller uses his connections to bring celebrities to Emmons, like Cleveland Browns running back Jim Brown. He also brings Little League Baseball to the community.
We started a baseball team. They had never had a bat. They'd never had a glove. They'd thrown rocks, but they hadn't thrown baseballs. Baseballs were expensive. And they got pretty good, and they saw themselves getting pretty good.
Rockefeller leads the building of a community center, the material for which comes primarily from an abandoned school building in another section of the county.
It isn't the Rockefeller Center that the world thinks of, but to the people of Emmons, West Virginia, it's just as important. Rockefeller Center, consisting of a community building and park, was conceived by anti-poverty worker John D. Rockefeller IV. The people, in appreciation, named the center Rockefeller Center.
John D. Rockefeller III visits Emmons for the official opening. Jay is also successful in getting the women of Emmons access to mobile health screenings and successfully petitions the Board of Education to extend school bus service into the rural community.
It was clear he loved the people, and they loved him. He was going to West Virginia to learn about poverty, learn about domestic problems, but now he'd fallen in love, and he was going to stay.
It was really, really hard emotionally to see what they were going through, emotionally to see the way they were getting shafted at every corner by every form of government, private sector. And I kept a diary every day, which I didn't read for 50 years. It was sort of like a sacred document to me. In reading that, I realized how much I grew, how I changed, how much they did, the people of Emmons, to make me who I believe I am. But you can't stay your whole life at Emmons. And if you are going to do something more, which I wanted to, it has to be at a level where the reach of what you do is farther. You had to be in politics. In West Virginia politics, in national politics.
You were hearing an excerpt from a film by West Virginia Public Broadcasting called Jay, A Rockefeller's Journey. The documentary recently won a regional Emmy Award, and you can watch the full documentary on our website at wvpublic.org. We began this episode listening to stories about some of the early organizing work of Young Vistas against strip mining in West Virginia. As we mentioned, Vistas today are not allowed to do this type of radical political organizing. But the Vista program is still the same in some ways. Today, there are still Vista volunteers serving all over the country. With the signing of the National Community Service Trust Act in 1993, President Bill Clinton expanded National Service to create AmeriCorps, and Vista has now expanded under that umbrella organization. And a new study released recently shows that West Virginia is one of the leading states when it comes to producing AmeriCorps volunteers. Those volunteers serve in Appalachia, but also across the country. Volunteerism is a strong part of West Virginia culture. Neighbors helping neighbors in times of disaster. It's what West Virginia native Bill Withers sings about in this song.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain. We all have sorrow.
So in this episode, we've been hearing a lot about young volunteers who came to serve in West Virginia during the 1960s. Today, things have changed, and Native West Virginians themselves make up a much larger percentage of volunteers serving communities in need. And get this, West Virginia has the fifth largest number of people in the country who are signing up to join AmeriCorps. Bill Basil, director of AmeriCorps, says he thinks one of the reasons so many West Virginians are signing up for his program is because many of them grow up volunteering in their local communities.
But it's that neighbor helping neighbor ethic, if you will, that ethic of homegrown service.
Basil adds another reason for his high number of AmeriCorps in West Virginia would be the lack of employment options in the state. AmeriCorps members serve 1 to 4 years and are paid a living stipend with health benefits. Volunteers also receive an education award at the end of their service. The Corporation for National and Community Service says volunteers living in rural areas have a 55% higher likelihood of finding employment after their service. Visit WV Public to find more information on AmeriCorps or to find local volunteer opportunities in your community.
I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody to lean on. Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend.
When President Lyndon B. Johnson spoke in December 1964 to the first 20 Vista volunteers, he gave them these instructions.
This is your job, to guide the young, to comfort the sick, to encourage the downtrodden, to teach the skills which may lead to a more satisfying and a more rewarding life.
One thing that remains true today, as it did back in the 1960s, is that Vistas and AmeriCorps all tend to learn a lot from the people they come to help. Virginia Bonds told me that although she learned a lot from the Vistas who came to Pine Knob, they learned from the community.
It was a big experience for them, same as it was for us, because they were all city people. I learned from them, and they learned from us, too. But like you know, you're from Wyoming County, you know everybody's friendly. Everybody's nice. So everybody got along real well, and we had good times. Really got to know each other.
Vista volunteer Naomi Cohen says she definitely changed in a lot of ways during her time working along Coal River back in the 60s.
It wasn't just that I moved to West Virginia, but I think that that year in Vista got me much more in touch with people than I had ever been in my life before, and got me to feel more at ease with all different kinds of people.
So what do you think? Do you remember when these Vistas came to town? What did you think about it? Were you a Vista? What did you learn? Why did you sign up? How do you feel looking back on it all? We want to hear your story with Vista, 50 years after the program began here in Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Billy Ed Wheeler, Montana Skies, Little Sparrow, Michael Klein, Alan Cathead Johnston, Ben Townsend, and Andy Agnew Jr. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.